Macmillan Audio presents Saving Sophie by Ronald H. Balson. Read for you by Fred Berman. Chapter 1. Pellets of rain and snow, driven by bone-chilling February winds, splattered the windows of Chicago O'Hare's International Terminal, occluding the view of those ticketed passengers trying to get a look at the tarmac. Intermittent gusts bowed the windows with an unsettling creak. Restless travelers paced the gate area, silently willing the gate agent to pick up her microphone and start the boarding process. After all, the flight from Chicago to Rio de Janeiro, from winter to summer, would take over 12 hours. Groans rumbled through the room as the beleaguered agent posted yet another delay. Sadly, she could offer no explanation other than, "It's weather-related." A tall, thin man in a blue sport coat, white polo shirt, and cream-colored Panama hat stood beside the Starbucks kiosk, a leather briefcase in one hand, his coffee cup in the other. He patiently scanned the crowd, until his eyes finally settled on a young student seated cross-legged on the floor, an olive backpack by his side. An open laptop, plugged into the wall, rested on his legs. The man pulled out his cell phone and meandered toward the student. "Yes, this is Dr. Summers," the man said loudly into his phone, pausing directly before the student. "What's your heart rate?" "I see. Where's Dr. Goodman? Who's attending?" He nodded as he listened. "Has she been stabilized?" Drawing an inquisitive stare from the student, the man continued in his high decibel discourse. "I'm at O'Hare about to board a plane." "To Brazil, for Christ's sake! Isn't Dr. Withers available?" Pause. Then calmly, with a sense of resignation, No, I understand completely. Yes, I'll cancel the trip. I'll be there in an hour." He ended his call, shook his head, and looked down into the face of the curious young man. "There goes my trip to Rio. I've been planning this for over a year, but when the congressman's wife has a heart attack, all bets are off." The explanation drew a sympathetic response. "Sorry for you, man. Guess you'll have to go another time." Summer shrugged and gazed at the passengers who were finally lining up to board. "Want to fly first class?" He held out his boarding pass. "You can have my seat. I sure as hell can't use it." The young man shook his head. "They won't let me take your seat. I have a coach ticket." "I purchased this seat. I don't see why it should go empty. We've already gone through security. We've shown our passports. The flight attendants don't know what I look like. Take my ticket. When you get on the plane, tell them you're John Summers. Who would know the difference?" The young man examined the boarding pass. "Seat 4A. Do you think I can? Do you think it'll work? I don't know why not. Go for it." "Hell yeah." The young man bounced to his feet, taking the boarding pass. "Thanks a lot, Doc." Summers watched him scan the boarding pass and proceed down the first-class jetway. Summers exited the international terminal and hailed a green and white taxi. The laminated license identified the driver as Delroy Johnson. Summers set his hat, attaché, and overcoat on the seat beside him. "Where to?" the cabbie said. Summers exhaled. "I'd like to go to the Milwaukee airport," he said quietly. The cabbie nodded and put the car in gear. "Up on Milwaukee Avenue, you mean," he said over his shoulder. "Now they're calling it the Chicago Executive Airport. Used to be Pawlwalkie Airport. That's in Wheeling, you know, about 15 minutes, but you have to pay a meter and a half." "No, Delroy," Summers answered as the cab pulled away from the terminal. I mean Milwaukee. The city of. General Mitchell International Airport. Johnson slowed his cab and pulled to the side. You serious? I don't go that far. I'm a Chicago cab. Shit, man, you at the airport. You could fly up there. Summers leaned forward. Delroy, I just want a nice, comfortable ride to Milwaukee. It's worth $500 to me. Will you take me? Well, since you put it that way, you're crazy, but for a 5-spot, just sit back and relax and let Delroy do the driving. 80 minutes later, Delroy glided to a curbside stop at Mitchell International. His passenger, who had slept most of the way, handed him a roll of bills. Thank you, Delroy. You have a nice day. Hey, thanks, you too, mister, Delroy called, leafing through the bills, but Summers had disappeared into the terminal. With boarding pass in hand, Summers walked directly to the security line. He shuffled forward and handed a Kentucky driver's license and his boarding pass to the TSA agent, who examined them and smiled. You have a pleasant flight, Mr. Wilson, she said. Summers nodded, checked the departure board, and walked to his gate. His flight to L.A. was lightly booked. Summers placed his leather case carefully into the overhead bin. It held a laptop, a trifold wallet filled with assorted credit and debit cards, and a change of clothes. On this day, at this fork in his road, that was everything he'd need. He took a seat by the window and watched the ground crew. 90 miles south, in the brick and steel canyons of Chicago's Loop, a group of businessmen and their attorneys gathered to celebrate the consummation of a business deal. Leland Industries had acquired the assets of Kelsen Manufacturing Company. The mood was ebullient. Champagne flowed. All of the tedious negotiations, the threats, the maneuvers, the posturing, were now history. The deal was sealed. The air was light. Walter Jenkins, managing partner of Jenkins and Fairchild, attorneys at law, stood by the conference room windows with his client, Victor Kelsen. Jenkins was tall, in his mid-60s, gray at the temples, and elegantly dressed. Kelsen, a few years younger, was stocky with a working man's physique. Plainly dressed in a suit from a department store rack, Kelsen's understated appearance belied the wealth he had amassed in his business career. The morning storm had lifted, and the setting sun painted long shadows in the Federal Plaza below. A visual metaphor, Jenkins thought. The end of days for Kelsen Manufacturing. Why, Victor, you're actually smiling, Jenkins said. I haven't seen that in quite a while. Well, why shouldn't I? I got a good price for my company, and now some other sucker can worry about the packaging market. He gestured across the room at a group of young men, uniformly dressed in 2-button shades of charcoal. Look at them all, Walter. Clinking glasses, laughing and joking. All my high-priced executives. So pleased with themselves to receive bonuses on the sale of a company they had no part in building. And I ask you, how long will that bonus money last any of them? These guys just don't get it. Leland Industries doesn't need any of them and won't keep them past next Christmas. And soon they'll all be sending out resumes in our dandy economy. Oh, they're bright people. I'm sure they'll land on their feet, Jenkins said. Anyway, are you taking Helen out to celebrate tonight? Nope, the Deacons are playing Northern and Helen hates basketball. But I haven't missed a home game in years and I'm certainly not going to start now just because I sold my company. And cleared $96 million. Jenkins reached across the table, grabbed a bottle of champagne, and offered to refill his client's glass, which Kelsen declined with a shake of his head. 96 before taxes, Walter. Listen, I gotta get out of here. I'm sick of looking at these guys. Took me 30 years to build my company. On my back. These MBA types think they bring something to the table. They bring nothing. It's guys like me who built this country, not a bunch of full-of-themselves finance majors with 6-figure salaries. Jenkins winced. Yes, well, I get your point, Victor. But you won't have to put up with that any longer. What time's your game tonight? Kelson checked his watch. 7:30, but I usually go early. He retrieved his wool overcoat from a rack, and Jenkins held it for him as he slipped his arms into the sleeves. Most importantly, Walter, what time do I get my money tomorrow?
We expect the closing escrow to disburse about 11 a.m. I'll have Summers over there first thing in the morning. I assume that Harrington will be there as well?
He'd better, that's why I pay him. That's another thing I won't miss, paying my good money to a gloom-and-doom CFO.
Jenkins took a sip of his champagne.
Speaking of your CFO, I haven't seen Harrington at all this afternoon. Is he going to join the bunch for dinner?
Kelson shrugged. As far as I know, I expected him to be here by now. It's not like him to miss a free meal.
But since you mention it, I haven't seen your man Summers either.
He feigned a chuckle.
They're probably both sitting in a bar somewhere discussing balance sheets and tax write-offs.
Jenkins smiled and patted Kelson on the shoulder.
Takes a lot of work to sell a $300 million company, and they've been the men in charge. I'm sure they'll be here soon. Relax.
I'll relax when the escrow closes and I get my money.
See you at 11 tomorrow, Kelson said, and left.
Chapter 2 Summers awoke abruptly as the plane's wheels bounced hard on the LAX runway. He shook the cobwebs from his head and checked the time. Barely an hour to make his connection to Honolulu. He lifted his carry-on from the overhead bin and stretched his cramped muscles. Emerging from the jetway, his hat pulled low over his forehead, he paused to survey the people standing at the gate. What would he do if they were already here? The FBI, the LA police, waiting to greet him. Not a thing, he supposed. Not a thing he could do. He exhaled a sigh of relief when no one paid attention to him. Head down, avoiding eye contact with someone who might later say,
"Oh yes, officer, I saw that man getting on the flight to Hawaii."
He ambled slowly through the crowd and made his way from Terminal 4 to Terminal 6, stopping to buy a newspaper and a couple of bottles of water. Taking a seat in a back row at Gate 16, he slouched and buried his face in the financial section. Boarding could not come soon enough for Summers. He had read the same page over and over, never managing to digest a single word. When the flight was finally announced, he merged into line with a noisy tour group and smiled at the gate attendant as she took his ticket, though he failed to respond when she said,
"Have a pleasant flight, Mr. Wilson."
A bittersweet memory stopped him as he stepped onto the jetway. The last time he'd boarded a plane to Hawaii, he was with Alina and Sophie. They were just beginning their first family vacation. Back then, he held hands with his giddy 4-year-old, who bounced along, full of glee, bursting with joy. Back then, he and Alina had smiled so proudly as Sophie skipped along beside them. But that was back then. His window seat was toward the rear of the plane, and for a brief time the adjoining seat was vacant. How fortunate, he thought, as he set his Panama hat on the empty seat and took out one of his water bottles. But as the doors were closing, a young woman, the last to board, rushed down the aisle and stood before his row.
"I think that's my seat. 22B?
Summers nodded, rose, placed his hat on his attaché in the overhead, and slid back into his seat.
"Must be a pretty special hat," she said, smiling. "It almost had its own seat all the way to Hawaii."
Summers returned the smile. He watched the belated traveler compose herself, organize her knicks and knacks, and settle into her seat. She was obviously of Polynesian lineage, with smooth, gentle features and rich black hair. He judged her to be in her late 20s or so, maybe 6 or 7 years younger than himself. Her skin was tanned, but her face was flushed, and her forehead was slightly moist, which Summers attributed to her dash to catch the plane.
"I almost didn't make this one," she said, still breathing hard. "Bad traffic on the 405.
She slipped her magazine into the seat pocket, took a series of deep breaths, and eyed the bottle of water in Summers' hand. He caught the look.
"I have an extra bottle. Would you like it?"
"Oh, God, yes. You're a lifesaver."
"Are you all right?"
Summers said, handing the bottle to her. She nodded.
Winded, oh, that's all.
I only had a few minutes. Summers thought of other things he could say to keep the conversation going, but decided against it. Perhaps at another time, in another part of his life, it would have been nice to start up a conversation with this pretty Hawaiian girl, pass some of the next 4 or 5 hours engaged in pleasant small talk, and maybe even catch up with her on the island. But given the present circumstances, he thought it best to say little and retain his anonymity. It would be safer if she didn't remember him. The pre-flight video started, and the plane pushed back from the gate. Summers let his eyes stray every now and then. She was leafing through her magazine when she caught him in the middle of one of his glances.
Malani,
she said with a smile, and held out her hand. Jack, Summers answered, shaking her hand and immediately sorry that he'd used his real name.
First time in Hawaii?
Yes, he lied. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, you'll love it. I've lived there all my life.
Summers buried his attention in a magazine. Malani took out her earbuds, untangled them, and was soon lost in her music. Chapter 3. In the Judean hills, south of Jerusalem, in the ancient city of Hebron, a group had gathered to celebrate a wedding. The midwinter weather favored them with kind temperatures and soft desert breezes. Though a few of the men wore black coats and wide-brimmed borsalino hats, most were dressed in white short-sleeved shirts and woven kippot. Women, young and old, surrounded the bride, whose train was carried by 2 young bridesmaids. A small group of musicians played traditional music as the joyful assembly danced its way up the stone pathway. The celebrants were not a part of the small community of Jews who lived in the H2 sector of Hebron, or the 7,500 or so who resided in the adjacent West Bank town of Kiryat Arba. The wedding party had traveled from Jerusalem by tour bus to witness the exchange of vows at the Tomb of the Patriarchs, Marat HaMachpelah, which Abraham purchased from the Hittites 3,700 years ago for 400 silver shekels, and where he, along with Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, and Leah, are buried. The young groom's eyes were locked upon his betrothed, and a broad smile lit his youthful face. The nervous bride breathed deeply, unable to exhale, as she carefully stepped her way toward the flowered canopy. While the party wound its way toward the sand-colored walls of the holy shrine, a black sedan, its windows down, approached from the south. Suddenly a clap was heard, then another. The startled bride grabbed her side, her legs buckled, and she fell to the ground. Crimson slowly seeped through the fabric of her white lace dress as her stunned entourage hustled her to the shelter of the security hut. More shots. 3 men fell. Rivulets of blood filled the crevices of the large stone blocks on King Herod's walkway. Guards fired at the sedan as it sped up and disappeared around the corner. Shrieks and cries from the wedding party drew some of Hebron's residents to their windows. The young bride, bleeding badly and suffering from shock, was carried to the tour bus and laid upon the seats. "She's losing too much blood," an elder said. "She won't make it back to Jerusalem," a woman pleaded.
"We need a doctor! Someone help us!"
One of the security guards spoke up.
"I know of a doctor, but he's Palestinian. Dr. Al-Sahani. He lives just north of here in the Arab sector, not too far." "Please!" the woman cried.
The bus traveled several blocks through the military checkpoint to a large walled compound in the north quadrant of the H1 sector. The guard jumped from the bus, ran to the gates, and pressed the buzzer several times. He was soon met by a powerfully built man whom he addressed as Bashir. After a short and excited discourse in Arabic, Bashir nodded and opened the mechanized gates. The bus pulled in and the unconscious bride was carried to the front door. Dr. Arif Al-Zahani, tall, slender, with a gray goatee and white hair neatly trimmed, came to the entrance.
"What is this, Bashir?"
"A girl has been shot, Said,"
he said with deference, pointing to the bride who was carried in the arms of her groom and 2 others. Al-Zahani stared at the security guard in the group. His gaze was stern and unfriendly.
"Doctor, please help us,"
the groom pleaded. He spoke in Hebrew, but the urgent plea was unmistakable in any language. Al-Zahani finally nodded.
I will treat the woman in the guest room, he said to Bashir. Keep my grandchild in her bedroom.
He led them down the hall, where the men laid the bride gently down upon the bed. Al-Zahani surveyed the wound.
You must all wait outside.
Al-Zahani worked for over an hour. When he emerged from the guest room, he spoke dispassionately, addressing his remarks in Arabic to the security guard.
She survives, but she has lost much blood and needs hospital care. You would be well advised to take her to an Israeli hospital.
The groom, his black coat splattered with blood and dirt, stuck out his hand.
Thank you so much, Doctor. God bless you. I will pay you whatever you wish, but no amount can ever repay the kindness that you have shown.
Al-Zahani declined the hand.
There is no charge, he said through the interpreter. Take her now to the hospital. Do not delay.
When the group had left, Al-Zahani turned to Bashir.
The sheets, the pillows, the bed itself. Dispose of it all.
Chapter 4 Walter Jenkins slammed the handset onto the telephone cradle. He'd been trying to connect with Summers since early afternoon. It wasn't as if this were an off day. Summers, who was J&F's top transactional partner and the point man on a $300 million deal, was AWOL. He was seen at the title company all day yesterday, monitoring the escrow submissions and doing what needed to be done to transfer all of Kelson's buildings, machinery, vehicles, and other assets to Leland. And then, he doesn't show up at the office. He doesn't show up for cocktails. Now Jenkins was getting damn tired of hearing Summers' voicemail message. Jenkins walked down to the 15th floor.
Where the hell's Summers?
He said to his secretary, who was getting ready to leave for the night.
I don't know, sir. People have been trying to reach him all afternoon.
Do you have any way of contacting him that I don't know about?
I have a cell phone number.
She shook her head.
But I've tried it. No answer. No answer at his home, either.
She shrugged.
Sorry.
Jenkins sighed.
Well, I guess there's nothing else I can do. I'm sure we'll see him tomorrow morning when the escrow funds disperse.
We'd better.
He may be out with Mr. Harrington. Some of the Kelson people have been calling and asking if Mr. Harrington was here.
Jenkins shook his head.
I can't find their guy either. Isn't that just peachy?
Victor Kelson arrived at St. Joseph's Arena as he customarily did, pulling up to the side entrance in his black Bentley sedan. His driver quickly jumped out of the car and circled around to open the back door. Deacon students in their coats and hoodies huddled on the sidewalk in the frigid evening air waiting for the arena doors to open. The usher guarding the media entrance smiled.
Good evening, Mr. Kelson.
The usher stepped aside and handed Kelson a program. A fixture at the arena, Kelson could come and go as he pleased. Same center court seat for the last 14 years. Two rows behind the deacon's bench. Kelson was the athletic department's most revered booster. He shook several hands on his way into the arena and arrived at courtside during warm-ups. Deacon players in their blue satin cover-ups were spread around the hardwood for the pregame shoot-around. A few players nodded or waved at Kelson. Two stopped their practice shots to give him a fist bump. Kelson wandered over to the baseline where Darius McCord was swishing corner jumpers.
Looking sweet, Darius, Kelson said.
Darius smiled a little.
Yes, sir, Mr. Kelson.
I think I'm going to see quite a show tonight. Nobody in Northern can guard you.
Darius never lost his modest smile.
I don't know about that, Mr. Kelson.
He spun to his left, pushed off the floor as if he were weightless, and arced an 18-footer softly through the bottom of the net. Kelson made his way to his section as the arena doors opened and the students scrambled for their seats. The band fired up, the cheerleaders bounced on the sidelines, the jumbotron came to life, and the arena's energy level began its rocket climb. A portly man in a deacon sweatshirt sidled down the second row to the seat next to Kelson. He set his cup of soda in the holder, took a flask out of his pocket, and dumped a shot or two into the cup.
Hey, Vic, what do you know? Good one tonight, huh?
Mismatch.
What's the line tonight?
11, last time I looked, but that's a soft spread. No way Northern contains Darius, more like 18.
Agreed.
The flight was midway over the Pacific. Dinner had been served, and the cabin lights were dimmed. Summers had consumed 3 little bottles of airplane wine and was finally relaxed enough to nod off. Alina was being coy. Her voice was soft and alluring, her dark eyes enchanting. Her sing-song accent made him chuckle. "Jacques," she called him. She rested her head gently on his shoulder, her silken black hair smooth upon his face. A hint of her floral perfume filled his senses. "I love you so much," he said.
"Shh, you'll wake the baby," Alina said.
He leaned over to kiss her, and she shifted her weight, jostling him a bit. Summers opened his eyes. Of course it wasn't Alina. He would never hold Alina again. It was his tardy seatmate, Milani, who had slumped to the side over the armrest, her head settling softly on his shoulder, her hair brushing his neck. She was sound asleep. "And I almost kissed this stranger," he thought. That would have been challenging to explain. The two sat just that way for the next half hour, her head against his body, her breathing slow and deep. Though his muscles were beginning to cramp, Summers sat very still. His legs were asking to be stretched, and to walk up and down the aisle would have done him good, but then he'd have had to wake her up. For as long as it would last, he'd let this woman's physical closeness touch off pleasant memories of Alina. Pleasant, but sad. Yet it calmed him, comforted him. He leaned his head back, shut his eyes, and gave himself to his memories. Back then, they'd been off to Hawaii on their daughter's first airplane trip. As the plane droned on, Alina and Sophie had busied themselves looking at pictures of the Hawaiian Islands in a magazine. Sophie's boundless and enchanting excitement drew the smiles of the neighboring passengers. "She is so cute," Jack heard one woman say, and he thought his chest would burst with pride. Soon, Sophie had dozed off. Alina snuggled next to Jack, and he put his arm around her shoulders and drew her close. Whatever Hawaii had in store, paradise could be no sweeter. Now, suddenly, the intercom barked.
"Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the seatbelt sign. There's some rough weather ahead. Please return to your seats and fasten your seatbelts until the turbulence has passed."
Milani opened her eyes and took stock of where she was, her head on Jack's shoulder, his arm around her. She looked up at Jack and giggled.
"Oh, I'm so sorry," Jack said, quickly lifting his arm. I was sleeping and dreaming, and I'm so embarrassed."
"I'm the one who should be embarrassed. I leaned on you. You should have awakened me or pushed me back in my seat."
From there, a conversation gained traction. He said he was traveling on business and was thinking about finding a place on the islands. She said her family was deeply rooted in the islands. They'd been there for generations. She was currently vice president for Hawaii Magazine, a periodical owned by her family. She handed a business card to Jack.
"Honolulu is quite a fascinating place to live," she said. "Hawaii has over 1 million residents and over 8 million visitors every year, every color, size, and shape. It's the crossroads of the Pacific. No matter who you are, it's the ideal place to melt into the mosaic of humanity."
"Very poetic," Summers said, as though the idea had not occurred to him. She turned her attention back to her music, and Jack returned to his thoughts. The time passed slowly for him, and eventually the plane touched down.
"I hope you find the right opportunity, Jack," Milani said as she walked down the jetway. "It was nice meeting you. You have a comfortable shoulder."
"Thank you," said Summers with a short laugh. Evening rain splashed hard against the banana leaves as Summers followed the covered walkway to the main terminal. Tired and hungry, his joints aching from his long journey, he merged into the crowd moving toward the baggage carousels. The fragrances of orchids and tropical foliage filled the hall, but did little to calm his nerves. Once again, Summers scanned the baggage area for law enforcement. Men with large chests and broad shoulders, in blue blazers, their hands clasped before them, their feet spread apart, eyeing the arriving passengers, waiting to spot Summers and take him into custody. But there were no such men, and Summers exhaled another sigh of relief. "Hello again, Hawaii," he said to himself. "A place of happier times long ago. Now you're just a spot for me to hide at the other end of the world." Without pausing, he walked past the baggage area, through the automatic doors, and directly to the taxi stand. 264 Kaiulani Avenue, please. The cab driver nodded and drove east in the direction of Waikiki. In his Trump Tower condominium, Dan Gibson started worrying about his partner, Denny Harrington. It was 1:30 a.m. It wasn't like Denny to be late and not even call. He'd never done that before. Gibson got out of bed, slipped on his robe, and went to sit vigil by the living room window. Not that he could identify anyone from the 53rd floor. He stared at the city lights below. Then he called Harrington's cell for the third time.
"Hi, this is Denny. I can't take your call right now, but..."
"Really, Denny?" Gibson said aloud as he hung up. "I know you had a gigantic transaction and a celebration dinner, but do we have to be so inconsiderate?" At 2, he called again. And at 3. At 4, he called the police. Chapter 5.
"Come, my precious little one. It is time for madrasa."
"No, Jati, please. I'm not going. I hate the school," said the little girl, her arms defiantly folded across her chest. She stuck out her chin. "I want to go home."
Squatting before his granddaughter, his hands gently on her shoulders, he spoke softly.
"Oh, my little Hafida, we have spoken of this so many times. This is now your home. Your Jada and I love you very much."
He smiled warmly and raised his eyebrows.
"And you must go to school."
The little girl, with fair skin and light hair, stood before her caramel-skinned grandfather and tightened her lips.
"This is not my home," she stomped her foot. "And I'm never, never going to that school."
Dr. Arif Al-Zahani stood and slowly shook his head.
"You are 6 years old. All children go to school. They do not stay home. And we will not argue further."
Tears formed in her eyes. She lowered her head.
"They make fun of me."
"Who makes fun of you?"
"Everybody. I don't know what they're saying. I can't speak Arabic. I don't know their games. They laugh at me. I hate them all."
"Bashir will talk to your teachers. We will see that no one makes fun of you. Now, get ready for school and Bashir will walk with you."
"I don't want to wear a hijab."
"Why not? It is just a scarf and a very pretty one."
Tears streamed down her cheeks.
"I want to go home, Jadi. I want to see my daddy. I want to be in my own room."
Al-Zahani patted her on the head, turned, and walked out, leaving the little girl sitting on the marble floor, her head hanging low against her chest. She rocked back and forth, clutching tightly to her stuffed bear. The brown bear was dressed in a blue sweater with a large orange C in the middle. She sat on the floor, cheek to cheek with her bear, and sobbed. Her bear understood. He was the only one who cared. In the next room, her grandfather called for Bashir. The solid, broad-shouldered man in his tan sport coat came into the room. His walk had purpose, his movement efficiency, his bearing befitting a calm, strong constitution. He was not a man to be trifled with. Bashir bowed slightly.
"Said,
please walk my granddaughter to school. Speak to the headmistress. Tell her I am displeased with the little one's integration into the classroom. The children are unkind. She tells me they make fun of her. We must see that such conduct stops immediately."
Bashir nodded.
"I will talk to the woman."
The large man walked quietly into the library and held his hand out for the little one. She slowly rose and put her tiny hand in his. Bashir looked down at her and gently said,
"We must leave the bear at home."
"His name is Sweetness," she said quietly.
He smiled, and sat Sweetness on the shelf. Hand in hand, they left together. Jenkins customarily arrived at his office early, but on this day, a day when his firm was in charge of closing the book on a $300 million sale, he was especially early. And he had an uneasy feeling. All his voicemail messages to Summers had gone unreturned. He paced the office and made a few more attempts to reach him.
"Damn it, Jack," he said to the ringing phone. "Get up, answer the phone."
Finally, at 8:30, he summoned Gil Roberts, a junior partner.
"Gil, you're seconding Summers on the Kelson deal, right?"
"Somewhat, but Jack wanted to handle the deal himself. I prepared some papers for him, but that's about all. I know the deal pretty well if you have a question."
"My question is, where's Jack? So far, I've been unable to reach him.
In the event he's sick or something and doesn't come in, would you make yourself available to tie up any loose ends and make sure everything goes smoothly this morning?"
"Of course, Mr. Jenkins. All of the deposits have been made. It's pretty routine."
Gil went to Summers' office to retrieve the file and prepare for the closing. Summers' papers and files were neatly arranged in stacks. A few personal items were here and there, a paperweight made from a painted rock, a marble bookend, and a framed picture of Summers standing on a beach, his left arm around the waist of his wife, and his right arm resting on the shoulder of his curly-haired, lithesome child. He picked up the photograph. Summers and his wife were in their swimsuits. Jack, a head taller than his wife, was still fit from his high school tennis days. Alina was lovely. She had smooth, gentle curves, long, dark hair well past her shoulders and parted in the middle. A classic beauty, dazzling in her two-piece suit. They made a handsome couple. Sophie, her nose scrunched up as she squinted in the sunshine, held a blue plastic bucket and shovel in her hands. "The perfect family," thought Gil. "What a shame." Gil found the Kelson closing paper stacked on the shelf over the credenza. He thumbed through them. Everything seemed to be in order. He picked out the unsigned copies of the two bank releases. Later that morning, when the title company received the signed originals, evidencing full payment of Kelson's loans, the balance of the purchase price would be dispersed to Kelson. Midwestern Title, the escrow company selected to close the transaction, had wire-transferred funds to pay off each of the bank loans the previous day. When Midwestern received the signed releases, it would disperse $96 million to Victor Kelson. All neat and simple. The parties estimated that the payoff would occur no later than 11 a.m., At 10 a.m., Gil called Jim Ellis at Midwestern to make sure everything was in place.
"Jim, it's Gil Roberts at Jenkins and Fairchild. Can I confirm that you are prepared to disperse Kelson's proceeds?"
"I thought Jack Summers was handling this deal."
"He is. I'm just helping out. Are we all set to disperse?"
"Not quite. I've got First Bank's release in front of me, but not the one from Exchange. They've yet to send over their signed release."
Gil knew that Exchange Bank was owed $88 million to pay off Kelson's commercial loan and would sign the release as soon as they got the money.
"Do you know whether Exchange received its loan payoff?" Gil asked.
"I'm sure it did. I wired the money first thing yesterday morning, the same time I wired First Bank's, but we don't have the Exchange release of lien yet."
"Not good. Kelson's money is supposed to be dispersed to him in an hour. Do you have any idea why there's a delay?"
"No, but I know they received the wire. I have the Fed confirmation number."
Gil ended the call, thumbed through the documents, and found the telephone number for the Exchange loan officer, Greta Domschultz.
"I have your release all set to go," Greta said, "but we haven't received our funds yet."
"Are you sure? I've been told the money was wired to you yesterday morning," Gil said.
"Ellis told me he had the Fed number."
"I'm sorry, but the money hasn't been credited yet. Sometimes these Fed wires are slow. It'll probably be credited later today. Why don't you call me back at noon?"
Gil was frustrated, but knew his hands were tied until the wire was received. He thanked her and went to talk to Jenkins.
"Well, this is just dandy," Jenkins said, standing behind his desk, clenching his fists. "Kelson will be here in half an hour, and he'll have my ass. I don't care what Dumschultz says. Call her back at 11, stay on her.
As he was told, Gil made the call at 11, but heard the same dismissive answers, along with, "I thought I told you to call me at noon."
He buzzed Jenkins.
"I'm sorry, sir, but Miss Dumschultz still maintains they didn't get the money."
"Gil, I'm sitting here with Mr. Kelson right now," Jenkins replied in an irritated tone. "He's not happy about this. And neither am I. Would you please find out what the hell happened to the wire and the release? Do whatever you have to do."
Jenkins set the phone down and forced a smile at Kelson.
"I'm sure this will clear itself up in a short while."
Gil looked at the telephone receiver in his hand. "Whatever I have to do? What does he think I can do?"
Kelson shifted impatiently in his chair and looked around Jenkins' expansive corner office. Antique oak bookcases and side tables bordered on one end of a 9x16 oriental rug. A Tiffany lamp hung in the corner over a small marble conference table. The walls were covered with distressed oak paneling, which Jenkins boasted was salvaged from the demolition of the old St. Aloysius Church on South Kildare. Jenkins opened a walnut humidor, took out a large cigar, held it under his nose, and lifted his eyebrows. He offered it to Kelson, who waved it off.
"It's a Cuban," Jenkins said. "But of course you'll have to wait until you get outside. Can't smoke in my own damn offices anymore."
Kelson shook his head.
"No thanks. I just want to get my money and be in my way."
"I understand completely, Victor. I guess Murphy's Law is hard at work on this deal. You know, if something can go wrong, it will go wrong."
Jenkins forced a nervous chuckle.
"But don't worry, we'll clear it up."
"So the bigger the deal, the bigger the fuck-up, is that right? Is that what you're saying?"
Kelson snapped.
"Who is this kid, this Roberts? What happened to Summers? Why isn't he working on this? Didn't I pay you guys enough?"
Jenkins shrugged.
He must be ill. I can't reach him.
What about your man Harrington? Does he have any idea why the wire is delayed?"
Kelson took his glasses off and rubbed his eyes.
"Fuck Harrington. Can't find the prick. All the days to go missing, Harrington decides to be a no-show on the day the escrow closes. His partner called me earlier this morning. He doesn't know where Harrington is either. In fact, he called the cops."
"The cops?
Missing persons. Must have filed a report because Harrington didn't come home last night."
Kelson swiveled to look out the window.
Jenkins rocked back in his chair and raised his eyebrows.
"Is this typical of Harrington?"
"Fuck no. You think I'd keep an irresponsible CFO? He was the most punctual, detailed, boring man I ever met. His partner says he's never done this before."
Kelson and Jenkins locked eyes as the same thought entered both of their minds. Harrington and Summers had been in charge of the entire transaction. Together. And now both were inexplicably missing. And so was the money.
Jenkins shook his head to clear that thought. Not possible. He'd known Summers for years. But still.
"I want my money, Jenkins," said Kelson, spitting out every word. "I hold your firm responsible."
He popped his finger on his watch.
"It's not 25 minutes overdue. I trusted you. I paid you a fortune. Now get me my money."
"I'm sure everything's okay. This is just a temporary snafu."
Jenkins dialed Roberts again.
"Gil, forget the phone calls. I want you to go over to Midwestern Title, sit at Jim Ellis's desk until this deal is closed, and make sure those proceeds are transferred to Mr. Kelson. Call me every 15 minutes.
Chapter 6. The Honolulu taxi dropped Summers at 264 Kaiulani Avenue, a two-story white stucco motel. The script above the office read, "The Coral Reef in Aqua Blue." A neon sign in the window informed the world of a vacancy. A balcony ran along the perimeter of the second floor. All of the motel's rooms were accessed from the outside. Summers opened the office door and a small bell announced his entrance. A corpulent man in a loose aloha shirt patterned with pastel coconut trees and hula dancers shuffled out of the back room. With his hands on the counter, he leaned forward and gave Summers a once-over.
Can I help you?
My name is Eugene Wilson. I spoke to you last week. I reserved a kitchenette, sent you an $800 deposit. The clerk nodded and stuck out his right hand. It was soft and sweaty.
Glenn, I got your deposit. You're in room 212 on the second floor. Nicest one I got, too. On the corner. I need $800.
I already sent you $800 in a money order, Summers said. We agreed on $800 a month.
Right, but the money order was a security deposit. I gotta have $800 more in advance.
Summers huffed, reached in his bag, and took out his trifold wallet. The slot inside the cover held a picture of his daughter. He selected a MasterCard and slid it across the counter. Glenn shook his head.
I don't take no credit cards. Cash only.
Summers pursed his lips. It's a debit card. Glenn was unmoved. It takes the money directly from my bank account. Don't worry, it'll go through.
I ain't worried. I just don't take no credit cards. Debit neither. This is a small, friendly operation.
You didn't mention that on the phone. Glenn shrugged.
You didn't ask. Is what it is.
Summers leafed through the bills in his pocket and slid $800 across the counter. He looked at the balance of his cash. I need directions. A place to eat and an ATM. Glenn nodded and pointed his pudgy index finger.
5 blocks to Kalakaua. All the big buck hotels are there. They got lots of ATMs and restaurants. But if you ask me, Cappy's Fish Shack round the corner got the best plates on the island.
Glenn handed 2 brass keys to Summers.
Check out Cappy's Garlic Shrimp. You won't be sorry.
Summers opened the door to room 212. The window air conditioner had been off and the air was stale. He flipped the switch and the fan came on with a rattle. He looked around. It was livable, minimally. The furniture had seen younger days, the woodwork had scratches and gouges, but the pieces were functional. The double bed had a chenille coverlet that had once been pink. A small tube TV sat on a melamine desk. The kitchen had a greasy odor, but the stove worked. Through the dusty windows, Summers had a view of an apartment complex across the street. Hip-hop music blasted from the bar on the corner. Summers took a 5x7 framed photograph from his case and set it gently on the bedside table. He kissed the picture of the little girl.
Soon we'll be together. And we'll look for a new home, he said to the picture. But now we wait.
The phone rang on Greta Domschultz's desk. She looked at the caller ID, shook her head, and pushed the speaker button.
If this is Gil Roberts, I still don't have your payoff.
Both Gil and Ellis hovered over Ellis's speakerphone at Ellis's horseshoe desk. The Kelson Leland escrow file lay open on the desktop.
Greta, I'm with Jim. Can you give us an update on what's being done to resolve this problem? Please?
What's being done by whom?
She said.
My task is to check to see if we've received your wire transfer, and we haven't. What are you doing to resolve this problem?
Gil reached for the Fed wire confirmation. Holding it in his hand, he waved it as though Greta could plainly see it.
I have proof that the funds were wired to exchange yesterday morning, Greta. Right here. I'm looking at the Fed confirmation. Maybe if you took a copy down to your wire transfer department, they'd be able to acknowledge receipt and we can put this to bed. Let me scan it to you along with the wire instructions that you signed.
She agreed. An hour later, the phone rang on Ellis's desk. The two men jumped to their feet and pushed the speaker button.
Gil, this is Greta, and I'm here with Jennifer Server. I took the liberty of contacting Jennifer after I received and reviewed your email. She's an attorney from our risk management department. Gil, it looks like you do indeed have a problem.
Jennifer interrupted.
The account identified on your wire confirmation is not connected to this transaction. Midwestern wired the funds all right, but it wired them into the wrong account. The funds were credited to a private corporation's business account, not the exchange loan account.
What? Ellis said. How is that possible? Midwestern wired out $88 million to the account identified on the exchange payoff letter that bears Greta's original signature. It's sitting right in front of me.
When I first looked at the paper, Greta said, I was also confused. I saw what appears to be my signature on your copy of the instructions. It initially fooled me too, but when I compared it to the payoff letter that I prepared, I saw the difference.
What difference? What do you mean? Ellis said.
Greta continued. Your copy has a different bank account number. It's not even an account at our main branch in Chicago. And it reads, for the account of Loan Services Company. You wired the money to an account belonging to some private company called Loan Services Company. There is no division at exchange called Loan Services.
But the wire instructions you signed,
no way. Someone altered the instructions after I signed them.
I don't have any idea how such a thing could happen, Ellis said. Both Harrington and Summers reviewed and approved the document. I followed the instructions exactly as written.
Let's not argue about whose fault it is. Let's reverse the wire, Gil said. Turning to Ellis, he said, get on the phone with the Fed and reverse the transfer. Get the money out of that loan services account and direct it to the correct exchange account to pay off the loan. Leaning forward and talking loudly into the speakerphone, Gil continued. Greta and Jennifer, would you please take whatever steps are necessary on your end to freeze that loan services account until we can straighten this out? The response was direct.
It's not in that account anymore.
In which account?
In any account, Greta said. It was withdrawn from the loan services account yesterday. After that, we don't know what happened to the money.
We're looking into it. That's why I have our counsel here. The line was silent for a moment. Greta, Gil finally said, please scan all the relevant documents and email them to me immediately. I'm going to seek an injunction to freeze that money.
You just don't get it. There's nothing to freeze. It's gone. It was wired out 10 minutes after it came in.
I'm going back to the office, Gil said. I have to confer with Mr. Jenkins. We'll call you later.
Call Ms. Server. She's in charge now.
Jenkins' door was shut when Gil returned. Is Mr. Jenkins in his office? He said hurriedly to the secretary. She nodded.
He's in there with Mr. Kelson.
She leaned forward and whispered.
In a real bad mood.
Who is?
Both of them.
Gil quietly said,
then would you buzz Mr. Jenkins and ask him to come out? Tell him I'm out here and I need to speak to him privately.
A moment later, Jenkins came out.
Well?
Gil shook his head.
Sir, this deal is screwed up beyond belief. No one knows where the money is.
What are you talking about? He answered in a hushed tone.
I mean that the title company wired $88 million to a bogus account in New York, and the money was immediately withdrawn by some stranger, and it's not there anymore.
Where?
Anywhere.
Jenkins pulled Gil into an adjoining office where a young lawyer was busy researching.
Would you excuse us, please, Jerry?
Jenkins snapped at the lawyer and waved his hand at the door, shooing him out. Please, now! With the door closed, Jenkins said,
what are you talking about?
What bogus account? What stranger? Explain this to me! When Gil finished, Jenkins said,
then Midwestern has to make it good. They're the escrow company. They have to send $88 million to exchange, not to some phantom account. The missing money's their problem. If they wired it to the wrong account,
they're not taking responsibility, sir. Ellis says he precisely followed the exchange payoff statement that was given to him, and he did. I mean, he followed the written instructions that I saw.
Then it's exchange's fault!
No, sir. Exchange denies that the instructions are genuine. They say it's an altered document, and what's worse is that both Harrington and Summers signed off on it. Greta Dumschultz insists that someone intentionally changed the numbers to redirect the funds. She had the bank's lawyer on the phone. No one will take ownership of this fuck-up.
Jenkins stood dumbfounded, like a stuffed grizzly bear in the corner of a Northwoods tavern.
Well, we need to inform the client. Let's go talk to Kelson.
They rejoined him in Jenkins' office, where Kelson sat nervously swinging his leg and tapping his fingers.
"Victor, does Kelson have a business account at Exchange's New York branch?" Jenkins said.
"What are you talking about?"
"Well, does it? Do you have an account called Loan Services?"
"No. Our accounts are all at Exchange in Chicago and in Evanston National on Davis Street. What's going on, Walter?"
"Mr. Jenkins, I think we need to get a hold of Summers or Harrington," Gil said. "They should have the answer. They're the ones who were present at the escrow with Ellis. They signed the disbursement statements. Right now, neither the bank nor the title company will do anything further. They both refer us to their legal departments."
"What's going on, Walter?" Kelson said again.
"I can't reach Summers," Jenkins said through clenched teeth. "But I'm sure there's an explanation to this debacle and a way to straighten it out. You can't lose $88 million.
"What do you mean, lose?" screamed Kelson.
"Hang on, Victor. Gil, go into Summers' office into the closing file and bring me our copy of the payoff statement, the one from our files."
Turning to Kelson, Jenkins said,
"Apparently, the funds were wired to some fucking account in New York called Loan Services and weren't applied to pay off your loan. From what I'm told, it was a private account and the funds were immediately withdrawn. This is crazy, but it's all the responsibility of Midwestern Title. They're the escrow company. They're charged with the responsibility of dispersing the funds into the proper accounts."
Gil double-timed down the hall to Summers' office and started thumbing through the papers. The sounds of breaking glass blasted out of Jenkins' office.
"Get this fucking deal straightened out, you idiot!"
Kelson bellowed. Gil rushed back to Jenkins' office. Everything had been knocked off Jenkins' desk. Kelson was storming out of the room screaming,
"I want that money in my account by tomorrow, you incompetent bastard!"
Jenkins, clearly shaken, looked at Gil.
"Victor took his forearm and swept everything off my desk."
Jenkins wiped his hand across his brow.
"I would have called the police, except if I were in his shoes, I probably would have done the same thing."
Gil bent down to pick up some of the items on the floor.
"Don't bother," said Jenkins. "I'll have it cleaned up. Where are the payoff instructions? What did you find in Summers' office?"
"Here, sir."
Gil handed over the exchange document.
"The numbers are definitely different. But, sir, I also found this as well. A receipt for a ticket to Brazil. First-class seat on American. For a flight yesterday."
Chapter 7. In the back room of the Breadstone Bakery, in the narrow winding streets just north of Hebron's Bab al-Zawahiriya Market, 10 powerful men, each an influence in his own way, sat around a circular mosaic table. A silver coffee urn with several small cups sat in the middle of the table.
"The coffee is good and strong tonight," said a thin, angular man, pouring a small amount into his cup, barely a sip. Fakir, the squat owner of the shop, nodded and chuckled.
"Turkish. None of us would object, Ahmed, if you poured a little more into your cup. Then you wouldn't have to get up so often."
"Never fill a cup so much you cannot see the bottom," Ahmed said. "I was taught that by my mother. It's sociable."
"Who called for the assault on the wedding party?" said Dr. Al-Zahani.
The men looked at one another and shrugged.
"What difference does it make, Arif?"
said Nizar Muhammad.
"How does it further our grand plan to shoot a young girl on her wedding day?
How does it help us to remain silent under subjugation and occupation?"
Nizar said.
"Everything doesn't have to stop because of our grand plan. Are you going soft on us, Arif? Was this not warranted? The group was defiling the Al-Haram al-Ibrahimi shrine with a Jewish ceremony and Jewish prayers. It's a Palestinian heritage site, and Israel is in violation of its international commitments by promoting ceremonies at Palestinian holy sites. Israelis now advertise buses to take people to perform Jewish ceremonies at the tomb of the patriarchs."
"Maybe Nizar forgets. It is precisely on those tour buses that we will carry out our operation. Or maybe Nizar would do it by camel train."
On a stuffed futon in the corner, Faiz Talib sat quietly, observing the banter. The eldest member of the group, he leaned his back against the wall. His head tilted forward, and his wiry beard rested on his cream-colored kurta. From his knitted takia to his laced sandals, his bearing bespoke composure and wisdom, affording him deference.
"Vitriol among us does not further anybody's plans,"
he said.
"What is your concern with the wedding incident, Arif? I myself authorized it."
"I care nothing for the wedding party or the people who were shot, including the bride, who some of you know was treated at my home. I care only about jeopardizing our operation. The public perception, the newspapers, CNN, they pick it up and use it in their campaign to portray us as barbarians."
"Maybe that's not so bad. Anything that creates fear in the hearts of our oppressors suits our purpose, no?"
"I don't dispute that, but the timing is bad. In the wake of our operation, it will focus attention to Hebron. It's bound to bring more IDF, more Israeli police. The IDF will now go door to door to dig up a suspect. For a tiny act of retribution, the swatting of a few mosquitoes in a wedding party, it increases the risk of our exposure."
The baker rubbed his grizzled beard and smiled.
"But maybe they don't come back so soon for weddings."
"Hmm?" The others laughed. Faiz held up a hand.
"What's done is done. Let's talk about the bus. What is our progress, Rami?"
"We have converted and painted an identical tour bus. It has a false floor, undetectable. It will be ready well before we need it. Aziz has already taken the job as a Jerusalem tour bus driver and is dispatched twice a week."
"And the bags, Arif?"
Al-Zahani nodded.
"Coming along."
Faiz stood and the others followed suit. They joined hands in a circle around the table.
"From the river to the sea,"
Faiz said.
"From the Golan to the Gulf," the group responded. "Blessed be the sons of Canaan."